Small town week, Jen. Small town is a weird thing for us to do. We don't know anything about small towns.
Well, we know about small town and romance, and that's what counts, Sarah.
It's true. Welcome to Fated Mates, everyone. I'm Sarah McLean. I write romance novels. I read romance novels.
And I am Jennifer Prokop, and I read romance novels and talk about them on Twitter.
A lot.
Fine. You know what? No. There's never too much.
Last week, someone tweeted and was like, "We loved your sports rant, Sarah. Can you have more rant?
Can you rant more?" And I was like, "You haven't seen our text messages, you guys." Which is probably a good thing.
But, okay, it's small town week, and you've got two city girls coming to you from our very urban centers talking about small town and small town idol and why we love small towns so much in romance.
Well, because you know what? Okay, remember Cheers, the theme song, I can make words, I promise, from Cheers, right?
Wouldn't you like to get away?
Sometimes you want to go where everybody knows your name.
Yeah.
I think that's the key to small town romance, is it's both the promise of it is that it's people who really know you. But that's also, it's like the greatest part about it is also the downside, right? Because the people that have known you, they maybe think they know you and they don't, or they've known you forever and you've changed. And so I think one of the built-in tensions of small town romance is how to navigate like the other people in the world who have an opinion about what's going on, as opposed to like really what could be the anonymity of a city. Like that sort of sense of like other people being bystanders or watchers is really kind of gone, I think, in like city romances.
Yeah. No, I think that's true. And I think also there is a very real sense of not being able to hide in a small town,
yes.
Right? So, and I think that's very much about identity. And maybe it's a good thing that we're talking about this in relationship to McGreeve, you know, right next door to McGreeve, because it feels to me like all of romance, what McGreeve sort of taught me is this idea that all of romance is really about personal identity and our relationship with ourselves, our relationship with our partners, and our relationship with the world around us. And small town elevates that world to a sort of a fever pitch. You cannot exist on an island in a small town. Everyone knows your business.
Right.
And it is interesting because I think we joke that it's so foreign a concept for us as city people, but the reality is like all cities are small towns too.
Yeah. And I feel like that's something that people don't really know because it just seems so daunting. But you know, like I tell this story about like when our son was little, we would like in the summer, we'd like ride our bikes up to 57th Street Books and look at books. And then we'd go three storefronts down and get ice cream and, you know, ride our bikes back home. I mean, and it's really idyllic in some ways. And I tell this hilarious story where right across the street from my school, there's like one of these UPS mailbox places where I have like an account. Like, right? Like, who has, I mean, there's like the grocery store next door to school. You can have like a store account. And it's so like old school hilarious where like I'll walk into the post office place and like give them some item with like a post-it note on it.
Yeah.
And they'll like charge it to my account and it gets where it needs to go. And so, you know, that part, like sort of the ease with which you can move through the world, I think, is really coded into small town romances. And it's something really appealing. And it's also, you know, everybody meeting on like the town square.
Sure. Which is, frankly, the genesis of the small, in my opinion, the small town contemporary romance is a direct descendant of the Regency novel.
Okay.
The Signet, what we think of as the Signet Regency. So in historicals, right, like technically everybody likes to say I write Regencies. I don't. I write pre-Victorians. But, you know,
Fancy.
That's just me being nerdy.
You know I love it, Sarah.
The Regency is a very specific period of time during history with Sarah. The Regency is a very particular period of time during which the madness of King George III was for real.
Yeah.
And he couldn't rule, so they asked his eldest son, who would become George IV, to basically rule in his stead, to rule as a regent.
Okay, I, like, literally never knew that. That's amazing.
Oh, well, I'm so happy we could get there together.
Perfect.
So, technically, the years of the regency are very sort of specific. However, once the Prince Regent becomes George IV, and then after that, there's sort of, like, a bunch of people no one cares about running the show until Queen Victoria arrives on the scene. And so those sort of those interstitial years, if you will, are often sort of
lovely,
bumped down into the regency. And basically, like, regencies mean a very specific thing to a romance reader, right? Like, there's a pretty dress and there's probably a ball and there's probably, like, there may be a country square. There's probably a Darcy-esque figure. So, like, you can draw a very straight line from Jane Austen, right?
Right.
Who was a contemporary romance novelist, it's important to note. Writing about kind of small Surrey towns. Like, I think about that moment in Emma, where Emma meets the vicar's sort of awful wife, and she says, oh, I've never been to Surrey, because why would I ever come to Surrey? It's town. It's, you know, my town is better. And Emma says, well, we are quiet people. But of course, they're not quiet people. That's what Austen's trying to say. I mean, that's all Austen ever does, is, like, kind of joke about, she pokes fun at these small towns where everyone knows who's dancing with everyone on Saturday night at the, like, cotillion. Everyone knows who saw who and who looked at who and who waved their fan at who in the town square and who rode out with who, you know. And so, and everything was under a microscope.
Yeah.
All action was under a microscope. And so, and there was always, there was, like, the lady, the old lady who saw everything, who, like, had a lot of money and, like, no one really liked her, but she was invited to everything anyway, and she was a horrible gossip. And, like, the guy who has a lot of money and has absolutely no tact, no one really likes him, but he has a lot of money, so you can't, you know, you have to have him in the room. Like, these kinds of things are very, they're bedrock in Austen, which was contemporary novels. In regencies, Heyer's regencies, like, Heyer loves this business. Yeah. Like, she's obsessed with these, like, conversations on the sidelines and all the sort of whispering gossip back and forth and how everyone knows everyone else's business. And then now small towns. And what's interesting about this is that one of the other reasons why I think small towns kind of instantly are drawn, like, you can draw a very sort of clear, dark line on the family tree from Austen through Heyer to small towns, is that it's sort of, you know this, Jen, but other people don't, but I've been asked to write a thing about Heyer and as sort of the grandmother of the genre. And I am very happy to do it because I do believe that, like, the bones of the genre are all in those Heyer books, but it's irresponsible for us to have this conversation without talking about, to talk at all about Heyer without talking about the fact that, like, the world she invented is still the world that Regency writers write in mostly.
Yeah.
And it's super white and it's super straight and it's, you know, it's anti-Semitic. The Grand Sophie is often republished without chapters, with chapters redacted.
Yeah.
Heyer invented this sort of rarefied, white, cisgendered, straight community, Christian community that didn't exist. Like, when you start to look at the actual data, it doesn't exist in historicals.
Right.
And it doesn't exist in small towns in America either.
Right. Well, and that's the part that I find really interesting about the small town romances that I enjoy the most are the ones that show. So there's this thing. So I've lived a lot of places in my life, right? I grew up in Cleveland, which I think most people will say is not, like, known for its coolness.
What hot spots got the hippest groove?
Cleveland.
Where all the real granddaddies move.
Cleveland.
Dig that sweet Cuyahoga glow.
It smells so good.
Cleveland.
Wait, there's a TV show, Cleveland Rocks. Wait, what is that? Drew Barrymore. Carrie. Not Drew Barrymore.
Cleveland. Cleveland does rock, but it's also known for, you know, people still make jokes about, like, the river being on fire, and that happened, like, you know, 50 years ago.
You're the one with the river on fire.
See?
But I knew that.
Well, but I think what's interesting is, like, I also lived in San Francisco, right? Which is a place kind of universally, like, thought of as being really awesome. And what Kelly says is that cool people are everywhere, right? And I think that one of the reasons that when small town romances are really, like, working for me, it's because I think the hustle and the bustle and the expense maybe of living in the city can really, like, squash, like, I don't know, like, sometimes idyllically I think, like, oh, if I lived in a smaller town, maybe I would have more time, right? Maybe I would have more space. Maybe I would have, like, it'd be more expansive. And I think, like, the best small town romances should be expansive and not, like, contracting, right? And some, there's definitely, like, are lots of small town romances that I don't really think we're going to talk about that are, like, really direct descendants from Hare's white, straight, you know, like, sort of homogeneous, maybe, right?
Yeah, that's a great word to describe them.
Because in real life, that's not how small town romances are. And although I have a lot of strong opinions about what makes them appealing in romance, I also think it makes me sound mean and like an asshole. So it's, like, not worth it to go there. I'm more interested in us talking about small town romances that are, like, really expansive about the people in this town really know you and love you. And so there's this way for you to be who you are there.
Well, that's the whole thing, right? We've talked before about how much I love a found family in a romance novel. Like, this idea that, you know, my parents are European, my dad's Italian, and my mom's English. And when they moved to America, they moved by themselves. We have no extended family at all in the continental, you know, in the 50 United States or even North America, period. And so my mom, acknowledging the fact that in the 1960s and 70s, it was going to be very hard for us to get back to family on the regular, she built us a family. And, like, the thing she coded into us constantly was, your friends are the family you choose. And that's probably why found families are so my id. But also, there's something about a small town that is about that found family. Is what you're saying is, everybody in town knows your business, but everybody in town loves you too, right? It's like, you can talk about my sister. Nobody talks about my sister but me, right?
Yeah, right.
And that's how small towns feel. Like, nobody talks about our neighbors but us. So there's that, you know, Chekhov or Tolstoy, a Russian, said at some point, you know, there are only two stories ever told. Like, man goes on a journey or stranger comes to town.
Yeah.
And this goes back to that sort of identity question, which is, every small town romance feels a little bit like Stranger Comes to Town, even if you grew up there.
Yeah, yeah, sure. Because I think the other promise of the small town, and this is very different from the city, is that it feels like unchanging, right? Like, people go back and, you know, such and such family still living in that same house, and, you know, that diner's been there forever. And that's not, I mean, city living is like an exercise in, like, daily change. It, you know, not just like the people around you, right? Like, I drive to work every day and leave my house at the same time, and never once have I seen the same car on the road. How is that possible? Well, because I live in a city with two million people.
Well, there's this great piece, Colson Whitehead, after 9/11.
Him.
I know. He's so great. He's so great. I met Colson Whitehead a million years ago. I worked in publishing. I worked for this, like, boutique PR firm. And he won something called a Whiting Award. Mm-hmm. And I was, like, the 12-year-old who they put on the account to, like, literally I hand wrote the invitations to the Whiting Awards. Like, that was part of my job. I got paid, like, $3. And that's what I did in my office for a long time. Anyway, Colson White had won a Whiting Award. And this tells you how ancient I am, because he's been writing for a while and he's been a superstar for a while. And the Whiting Award is only given to brand new, sort of unsung, unheard of authors. Anyway, at the time, it was 2001 and it was right after 9/11. And the New York Times asked a collection of young essayists, maybe old essayists too, to write essays on New York City. And I often give the Colson Whitehead essay to new New Yorkers, because one of the things that he talks about is that cities are so constant, they're living creatures, right? They're constantly changing. And so everybody's experience, my New York is not the same New York as my husband or my daughter or my mom or my dad, right?
Like,
I lived here during 9/11 and Eric didn't.
Yeah.
And so when I look at the skyline, there's something missing.
Yeah.
I can see where the Twin Towers were and they're not there anymore.
Right.
And when Eric looks at the skyline, he just sees the Freedom Tower. Like, he doesn't know. He doesn't know what's missing, because his New York is totally different than mine.
Yeah.
And what's really fascinating about this is that sense of, like, city and not city, but hometown as identity. Right?
Right.
And when you get, and when you, you're absolutely right. You know, I go home, I'm from Rhode Island. I'm from a small town called Lincoln in Rhode Island, although not that small, according to Twitter. Like, I went home 2 weeks ago for Easter, and my mom was, and I was driving down, like, the, you know, main street, which is nothing. It's like a CVS and a gas station and a drugstore. And the drugstore has, they tore down the drugstore and they put up this, like, palace of a drugstore.
What?
And I was like, oh, and I walked into my mom's house and my mom goes, did you see the drugstore? Like, it had, like, it was a revolutionary change. Because it was, that drugstore had been there for 40 years.
Yeah.
And now.
Right. So, I mean, I think that's it. Like, the landscape of the small town, the promise of it is that it doesn't change that much. Right.
Sure.
And, but the people in it are the same. And I think,
well, that's why,
yeah, that's interesting.
Stranger Comes to Town is so world ending for a small town romance, right? It's, you think about, you know, any one of those old Regencies where, like, a handsome unknown man with
appears at the ball,
a year,
right,
turns up and, like, everything's set on fire.
Yeah.
It's because he's basically a new Cumberland Farms.
Well, and I think that, I mean, of course, like, this is the trope. Like, in real life, well, the other thing I think is interesting about romance is that it's either small town or big city, but it's never the suburbs, even though so much of America is suburban. And I think because it's, like, the you know, setting means something, right? Setting
is
important.
What do you do in the suburbs? Like, where do you go?
Yeah.
Who, like, is there a fantasy to falling in love at the mall? I don't know. I don't think so.
I think what it is it's the...
In YA.
In the YA it is, right? But I think what it is it's the suburbs have the kind of anonymity that the city has, but not the charm of the small town or, like, the excitement of the big city. Like, it's sort of too generic as a setting to have it really, like, mean something in a romance, right? And so, therefore, it either just fades away or, right, like, you make this other choice.
Well, and also a small town romance is like writing a play, right? Like, you can literally put everybody on stage all at once.
Sure.
Right? The vet and the cupcake baker and the bookstore owner are all in line at the bank.
Right.
And the guy who runs, and the bank teller is, like, the police chief's wife.
Yeah.
You know, and so there's a constant sense of, at any point you're going to see somebody you know. You know, I think about all the big small town series, the Robin Carr and Marie Force and Debbie Macomber. I mean, Debbie Macomber has spent so much time building out her series that she hosts a reader conference, a reader carnival there in the town, you know, out in the Pacific Northwest every year because people want the experience. They want to feel like
they're in
the place, you know. Well, Nora, there's the Boonesboro series.
Oh,
and literally Nora Roberts Boonesboro, Maryland is where she lives. It's where she owns the hotel. She owns the bookstore. Like,
right.
You can go to Boonesboro and experience the Nora Roberts Boonesboro of the books.
Yeah.
And maybe fall in love with the guy who, you know, owns the pizza place.
Obviously. Well, and like I think of Farrah Roshan as having really interesting, like, and often the small town romance in that case, it's really built on like the families, right? So the way like a big family full of like siblings then like both expands the limits of the small town, like they're falling in love and they're adding new people and it's the literal lifeblood of the town, right? Mm. That mm-hmm. we sort of see because as people in the town are like building partnerships and families, like we see the future of that town, right? And yeah. I don't.
This town is never going to get consumed by a Walmart.
Right.
Like this Main Street will live forever.
Yeah. 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 And I don't.
And maybe that's part of it. Maybe it is. I mean, I hate the term economic anxiety in 2019, but like maybe that's a piece of it, right? That sort of sense of like the jobs are going and
yeah,
Walmart is taking over these towns. Like it's a lot harder.
Yeah.
To find a Main Street.
Well,
but it's not hard in books.
Yeah. And I think that that's something, at least in my books, that it will be really interesting. But I think one of the things we talk a lot about is like the beats, right? Like how romance hits certain beats. And I know the first book you want to talk about is like not a classic small town romance, but it is in the way that
it's
it hits
so
those beats.
So classic though. So I want to talk about Sierra Simone's Misadventures of a Curvy Girl. And first I want to give a shout out. So you all, Sierra joined us last week to talk about McGreeve. And it's no surprise. It will come as no surprise to anybody that I think this actually might be the first author who I've recommended twice on an over interstitials. And part of the reason why I'm doing that is because I really think Sierra is one of those writers who is writing just at the top of all of our games. Like, I think she is fearless as a writer. And what I love about what she's is doing is taking kind of classic subgenres of romance and just like flipping them over.
Yeah.
And re-delivering them. So what I'm talking about is, for example, I've said this before on the podcast and in basically anywhere anybody has ever heard me talk for the last 5 years. But I think Priest and Midnight Mass and Sinner, which is the trilogy or the 2.5-a-g of her, you know, Priest series is one of the very best inspirational romances ever written. And the reason why I feel that way is because an inspirational has a very clear set of rules. And one of those rules, the sort of only rule, is that it's a love story between three entities. It's the hero, the heroine, and God in the case of these books, right? And so what ends up happening in this book is there's a moment, and it's incredibly blasphemous, and we're all friends here by now, but the hero and the heroine, the hero is a flocked priest.
Like flocked, that's a Christmas tree.
Well, he has a flock. And so he anoints the heroine with oil on her bottom, and they do it on the altar. In the bottom. And when they do this.
I can't even look at you right now. Okay, fine.
When they do this, you're in his POV. It's first person male POV. And he thinks to himself, like, this, he is a priest. And like, in not, he is married to God. And he thinks in that moment, like, this is the closest to God I've ever been. This is the holiest this moment has ever been. And I have ever felt in this place, at this place. Jen's making a face at me.
I'm like, because you said holy. Sorry, everybody.
Jen.
Oh, yeah. I'm the bad one in this scenario. I'm the bad one.
I was tastefully describing a very tasteful blasphemy, and you took it to a different place.
Always. I'm always going to take it right there.
Anyway, so that's Priest, and let's set that aside because I want to talk about what she's just done to small town romances. So Misadventures of a Curvy Girl is set in the Heartland.
Yeah.
Sierra is from Kansas. She lives in Kansas. She loves Kansas. It is set in farm country in Kansas. And the heroine is a fat character who has is very experienced in marketing. She's a social media genius, and she is given basically a job to go off into the heartland and take a bunch of pictures for like a Visit Kansas like tourism board, whatever. So she gets the name of this town, and she goes off to this town where it's like idyllic farmland. Like it's like a Sunny Time lemonade commercial with like sunflowers and soybeans and farmers. And
really handsome farmers.
Real handsome. So she gets out there to the farm where she's supposed to be taking pictures of, you know, men in the fields. And she meets man who is supposed to be in the field. And he is freaking dreamy. And
yeah. And he's so instantly into her, and I love that.
He just loves her. He's, like, instantly into her. It's amazing. And because it's Sarah Simone, that's not enough.
No, of course not.
The farmer grew up, went to high school with another man who became a soldier, as many, many American boys do become, and went off to three or four tours in Afghanistan, comes back, has PTSD. And he and the farmer and the soldier, live together. They love each other very much. They are best friends, and sometimes they bone.
Yep.
And when the farmer meets the heroine of this book, he's basically like, oh shit. And he picks up the phone and he calls his friend at work and he says, I found her. Like, I found the woman who is going to be the third to our, she's going to complete us.
Yeah.
And it is
hot.
Bananas sexy.
Yeah, like, that scene in the barn. I mean, I know last week we were like, the barn. But I'm doing it again. Fine.
Yeah, the scene in the barn is real great. And then what's really fascinating, though, Jen, is what you talked about is this sense of like, the promise of the premise of a small town is that everyone in this town is going to ultimately
accept
love
you.
And accept you for who you are. Yeah. Warts and all. Not that, you know, this is a wart, but the reality is that like every person in this town loves them and
wants them to be happy and knows, right? Like that, I can't remember the soldier's name, Pete, maybe? I might be making that up, but like,
honestly, I can't remember either.
Yeah. Like knows that he's sort of tortured by what he's been through and wants him to, I mean, and that's the part, like it's really moving, right? Like that the town wants wholeness for them, right? Like the townspeople, yeah. Right?
But then on top of it, what I love is I love this new movement that we have in romance toward just like writing acceptance into the books and like not fucking dealing with it anymore.
Yeah.
Like I'm tired of the storylines where it's like the whole conflict is like, well, they're in a menage and what if everyone hates them, right?
Yeah, right.
At one point, the heroine says, Ireland is the name of the heroine, and she says like, well, isn't everyone in the whole town going to be like,
yeah, judging
hey,
us.
What's the deal with the three of you? And the response is, well, no, because a while back there was like on the other side of town, an older couple had a third and like, you know, it was a threesome out there, a polyamorous relationship out there, and everybody's fine with it, so we're fine over here. Like, this is like the pocket of the heartland where like Menage is totally fine.
Menage and, County, but, Kansas. It's famous.
Menage County, Kansas.
Oh, God.
And then can I just say, like, on a personal level, like, as a fat girl, like, as a girl who, like, has struggled with body image her whole life, Ireland is so relatable.
Oh, yeah, me too.
Especially because, again, like, it's sort of in that in 2019 where we're all supposed to be cool with our bodies, right? Like,
yeah,
you know, there's that, like, kind of push to, like, you want to have a swimsuit body? Like, wear a swimsuit. And then, look, congratulations. Yeah. Like, I love that, and I want so much to live in that myself, and I try really hard to live in that. I have a daughter. Yeah. Like, I try really hard to do it, but, like, it's hard sometimes. And Ireland tries really hard, too, and sometimes it's hard for her. And this isn't about, like, her thinking she's unattractive and then, like, having to see herself through Ben and Caleb's eyes. This is her thinking that she, like, this is her, like, actively working. She is the proactive one, like, trying to work to appreciate her body and what it can do and what it is and who she is. And Caleb and Ben just happened to be in love with her too.
Before we move on, I also like want to give a shout out to like, I'm not a huge like note taker in books. It's not something that I always like mark, you know, kind of quotes or whatever, but this book had a, and of course I like can't find it right now, which is really annoying me, but this, this part where she's like, I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to talk about it. And they talk about, like, one of them observes, like, he'd been in, like, essentially polyamorous relationships for years, and he knew a hard limit when he'd heard it. And I remember thinking, like, it was such an amazing line to me, because often when we talk about limits, we're talking about, like, your sexual limits. Mm-hmm. But in relationships, you also need to have people that respect your emotional limits.
Yeah.
And I thought that that's what this book was so beautiful at doing, was really, like, and that's actually maybe a really good pivot to talking about like my next book, which has a similar setup, but kind of the reason I like it is really different. And it's called Three Way Split by Elia Winters. I think I'm saying her name right.
You love Elia Winters.
Oh my God. I'm like to you the point where her. I'm like, I do. I'm like, Elia Winters, where have you been all my life? Why didn't I know about you? But you know what? It's also a bright side. It was a Rita book I read. This was a Rita Amazing. Finalist this year. And I also, I'm going to like squeak in talking about her second book in the series, which comes out May 20th, which will probably be close to when this gets released.
Which I just downloaded. So I'm excited because I've never read an Elia Winters book. Well, and I'm super excited.
Let me tell you, I think erotic romance can be real tricky because it's very easy to have it, you know, like there's sort of that classic definition of, you know, like the sex really develops the relationship, but we still need to see that emotional connection. And we saw it in Emmick Reeve. We saw it in Misadventures of a Curvy Girl. And I think Elia Winters is doing a really amazing work with it. And in this book, which the small town in Three Way Split, and then the one that's coming up is called Just Past Two, is Mapleton, Massachusetts. And I think it's like a made up town. And in Three Way Split, it starts off with Hannah Stewart is our heroine. She owns a sex shop in town, but it's like struggling, right? Like she's at a couple year mark where she was like kind of really hoping to like make it, you know, like have the shop be successful. But it's just like she can't quite make it happen. And it turns out that she's renting on Main Street, but it's really expensive. But she's had this crush on like local restaurant owner Mitchell Fredericks. And like,
I love the name Mitchell.
I know. And they've been like flirting, but he's like a little reticent and it's really hard to tell what's going on. And then Mitchell is roommates with this guy named Ben. And it turns out that Mitchell and Ben have been essentially like roommates for 6 or 7 years. And like on again, off again lovers for 5 or 6 years where they get together, but it's not, they can't admit they have feelings for each other. But when Hannah
like
enters,
friends with benefits.
Yeah, exactly. But when Hannah enters and they have some smoking hot sex, like first her with Ben and then her with Mitchell and then the three of them, that somehow this cracks open this ability for them to talk to each other. And to really, like, figure out what Ben and Mitchell mean to each other. Now, all of that being said, though, that's not why I picked it as a small-town romance. What I loved, I was like, that's all great. But what I loved about this book was the look at, like, owning one of those small-town shops.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's, like, a chamber of commerce. Like, there's, like, a huge plot of this book circles around the Chamber of Commerce wanting to hold, like, essentially, like, a fall night fair where all the local businesses have a booth. And, you know, Hannah's like, can I afford to have a booth? And she ends up pairing with Mitchell and Ben own this restaurant together and doing sort of, like, a bruise and sex toys kind of booth. And, right, like, it's almost like these funny pairings. Like, with this glass of wine, you could use this vibrator. But it's so cute. But that's something I really struggle with when I read small town romances is I'm like, okay, I buy.
What does everybody do?
Yeah. And look, I buy $5 cupcakes, right? I do. I bought a $5 cupcake in this city. But like, can a small town really sustain a cupcake shop like that, right? Like, how is that working? Well, this book, I think what this book does so brilliantly is really, like, dig into that, right? And her feeling that, like, the town accepts her shop, but only so far. And you know what I mean? And I think that that's the part that's really interesting is, and in the second book, which is called Just Past Two, and it comes out May 20th, it's a couple who essentially they go back to her high school, her college reunion. And he discovers that she has had this real wild past, and they actually inadvertently, they're like inadvertent voyeurs. Like they, like a couple comes out and has,
I love that.
I so love that. And they have,
that's your id.
Oh yeah. And they have sex right in front of them. And it just turns the two of them on so much. And they go off onto this journey of like self-discovery 10 years into what seems like a happy, but maybe a little bit of a boring marriage.
Sure.
And a big part of that too is like, we didn't know that people in Mapleton were doing this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And that's awesome. That's the part I love about a small town is you think you know everybody, but do you?
Yeah, that's really nice.
Oh, it's so good.
Yeah, that's really great. So my second book is actually also, it's similar in the sense that, so Vanessa North, I toyed with doing this for our sports episode too. It's Roller Girl.
I love this book.
I mean, you know, I love Roller Girl. I've loved Roller Girl from the moment it came out. But so Vanessa North has this small town series called Lake Lovelace, and it's in classic Vanessa form. Like, it's not just small town; it's also small town and sports.
Mm-hmm.
The first book in the series is about a wakeboarder. I mean, it's also like it. It's so great because it's also just like weird sports. I mean,
right.
That is like I said with love and not judgment. But the what's interesting is I have this like the first book is Double Up and it's called and it's about a wakeboarder. And then the next and like a person who wants to learn to wakeboard. And then there's Rough Road, which is so Lake Lovelace is on this kind of idyllic lake. And each of the books queer romance series. So the first one is male, and the second one is first one you would love. It's male wakeboarding age difference.
Yeah, nice.
The second one is Rough Road. And it's male, and one of them is like there's a car accident at the beginning, and like one of the and like this very rich sort of like the rich guy who doesn't have to have a job, he's so rich kind of guy, drives off the road. And then a guy who's working on the side of the – like he's like a road worker.
Yeah.
Goes and saves him. And they are also, I want to say, age difference, but it's class difference and like classic Vanessa fashion. Like she sort of explores all of that.
Yeah.
And they also have a kind of BDSM-y kink. Like they're into rough sex. And then Roller Girl, which is such a great book about female relationships.
Oh, it's so good.
Heroine, it's female, and all of it, it's just magnificent. The heroine, Tina, it is a little stranger comes to town. Tina has come from, they've lived in this town, but not very much. And she is trans and has just transitioned. So she was married and she decided – she is trans. She decides she's going to go through her transition. And she tells her wife and goes off to sort of find a new community of people.
Yeah.
And what's fascinating is that she's in the prior book and she goes into the wakeboarding shop and the wakeboarding community, all the guys from the prior book are like, they kind of know.
Yeah.
They're like there's a moment in this book where Vanessa writes, you know, in Tina's POV, like, they all kind of understood what was happening to me before I did and before I had, like, really told any of my actual family.
Yeah.
And the reason why I'm saying all this is because it goes back to that sort of found family, like, community becoming family, community acceptance, community love. The entire arc of the story of Roller Girl is there's so many little mini plots of Roller Girl that are about community.
Community,
love.
Absolutely.
And the whole book is about female relationships. So what's great is, so Tina is now living in the house where she and her wife, her now ex-wife, did live. And they are not together anymore. And it begins with, like, the dishwasher breaking down or the washing machine. Something breaks
some
down.
Some plumbing thing, right?
And she's like, oh, fuck. I've never had to deal with any of this because Lisa, her ex-wife, always dealt right. with it. And so she calls Lisa and is like, what do I do? And Lisa was like,
call a plumber,
you ding-a-ling. And what I should also say, one of the things that I love the most about this book is that Lisa is just great.
Like, oh, yeah,
she's an
right.
ex-wife who's not evil or bad or mean in exactly. any way. Like, she's not jealous. She just is a cool person who's like, I just want you to be happy.
Right.
So she's like, call a plumber. So she calls Joe Delario's plumber service, thinking Joe is going to turn up. There are all these, like, kind of like little winks, right?
Yeah.
Thinking Joe is going to turn up and it's going to be, you know,
Joe
Delario, like, butt crack hanging out. And it's Joanne Delario who shows up, who is banging hot.
Yeah. And competent, right? Like, the competence porn is big time. Oh my God. Right?
She comes in. She's like, I'm going to fix your business. I mean, all of your business.
Yes.
Like, I'm going to fix your broken dishwasher and whatever else is going on with you that you had to call your ex-wife because you don't know plumbers exist. Yeah. Like, I'm going to fix all of it. Oh, and by the way, I'm the captain of a roller derby team.
Yes.
And you're super sporty. Tina used to be a wakeboarder and right. is no longer. So she's like, come be on roller derby.
Yeah.
And what ensues is this, like, wonderful romance about two women who love roller derby and each other. And it's also, there's, like, this, like, the conflict of it is, well, Joe is the captain of the team and Tina's new. And, like, is it, like, I think it's, like, so taboo light.
Yeah.
Like, there is sort of, like, well, can they really be together because one's the captain and one's new? But, like, Sierra Simone would roll her eyes. They would roll out of her head if she heard me refer to this as taboo. Like, but it is the conflict because it also, like, sure. there's this family of women.
Yes.
The whole team
yes.
has a specific dynamic. And now what happens when there's a relationship
yeah.
internal to the team?
And I think that there's definitely Tina's fears about being accepted as a trans woman. And her journey into, I remember very vividly, like a really poignant moment where Lisa sort of, like, explains to Tina that, like, is, like all women fear violence from men, right? And for Tina to be learning this, where, like, most women learn it when they're teenagers, right?
Yeah.
And I think, so that's part of it, that I think it's, like, really sensitively done. It's not the main conflict, but it's, I think it's part.
No, in fact, it's.
Yeah,
It's
not a conflict. It's a, yeah.
Everybody on the team to Joe, it's a non-issue.
Right. But I think it's like Tina's journey. But I think yeah. one of the other parts of Tina's journey is there's this whole part about, like, learning to skate. And being able to, like, right? Like, there's a whole thing you have to, there's all these, like, tasks you have to be able to do. And
they all have nicknames.
Yes.
Roller derby.
Yeah.
It's
great.
I hope you can hear, like, how delighted I am by this book.
Was a book I read with a smile on my face.
Yeah.
Right?
I went to Smith and, like, this felt like going back to Smith in some ways. Like,
oh.
It felt like, you know, there's just, like, a group of women who, like, both love and hate each other, but, like, again, no one talks about my sister, like, but
yeah,
me.
Right, exactly.
So it's, and it was, it's harnessed, it was sort of the perfect, all that drama that comes with being in a community of women,
right?
But also all the, like, love and joy and partnership
and support and the, like, you can do it. Like, the first time Tina does some, and I feel like what I want to describe is, like, you have to be able to, like, jump and skate at the same time or something, right? it's like the first time she does it, it's like everyone is so excited for her because she did it. And I, and I loved it. I did. I like, this is a book that made me feel giddy. Like it just, there was so much joy in it. And I think that was part of it. It was like the roller derby stuff was just so great. It was
amazing. I like the whole series, but this is my favorite. It's my favorite Vanessa North book for sure. I just think it's delightful. And also, I just think it's a perfect small town romance because it is, talk about like a ballroom full of people who are gossipy and like
now, and watching
everything. Yeah. You know who you can't hide a relationship from? 30 women.
On your roller derby team. I know. Oh, Kelly loves skating, and every Halloween, her Halloween costume involves skates. So she's been like hell on wheels and like she's like, I get to wear roller skates to work. Like my, you know, it's awesome. And I was like, yeah, it's pretty amazing. So that's a really good one. Okay, well, let me do my last one, which I really struggled with this one only because I feel like everyone's read it. But then again, I'm like, maybe you haven't or you need to be convinced, but it's
or it's on your TBR.
Yeah, it's on your TBR and you haven't moved it up. And it's Alicia Rye's Forbidden Heart series, which I think, again, is being a really classic small town romance, but with the twist of the feud, right? That you have feuding families. And there are three books in the series, Hate to Want You, Wrong to Need You, and Hurts to Love You. I had to write those down because I always get them wrong. I'm like, Wrong to Want You, Hurts to Need You. And she's like,
no. We're not great at titles.
It's fine. We have a lot of, we're fun in other ways.
We all know this.
And I like them all. And I think, so the feuding part is essentially that in this small town, you have the Chandlers and the Canes. And the generation, the parents essentially of the main characters, because it's, you know, a Kane and a Chandler kind of getting together. It essentially there was, the big thing is like something went down and one of the families like swindled the other one out of their shared business. It's
a little Montagues and Capulets.
Oh, big time. There's a reason. Hatfields and McCoys for sure. And I think then it's interesting because again, the thing about a small town is those, memories are really long, right? And so that's one thing I really liked about this book. And that's
really a great point.
Yeah, yeah. Right? There's no way to, I don't remember anything in Chicago, right? Like it doesn't have that same weight necessarily, but in a small town, those memories, everyone has a part of that story. Everyone was there to see it happen. Everyone thinks they know something. And I think that these books really brilliantly play with it. And my favorite of the series is actually book number two, although you just have to read them all. And so I'm going to talk about book number two, but you have to read number one. And the book number two is called Wrong to Need You. And it's Stranger Comes to Town, and it's about Jackson Kane, who left town 10 years earlier. And everyone knows that he committed an act of arson, and like they had to cover it up, and he fled town. And he is finally coming back, and what happens is he falls in love. His brother, Paul, has died, and he falls in love with Paul's widow.
Oh, I love a widow story.
Yes.
I love a widow story.
And she is so, and so in the other part, okay, we talked about businesses. Like, this book really has it all to me. She is essentially keeping their family business alive, which is this small diner, but she hates it. She hates the diner. She's not a very good cook. It's just the thing that she has to do. She has a side gig as a bartender, and she really likes that. She likes the small talk. She likes mixing drinks. She's also openly bisexual, and like it's a way for her to like sort of meet those needs, right? So when she works the bar, if someone, a man or a woman, catches her eye, she might take them home. And one night someone catches her eye, and she approaches them at the table, and it's Jackson. And so this whole, like, and she had never seen him that way before, but seeing him again after all these years, right? And it really, like, puts this like, you know, it's like all of a sudden, and of course, I mean, it's her husband's brother, and she has a large extended family, a family of siblings who don't approve of her, like they're all doctors or something. And so it's also about like the weight of your family's expectations. And I mean, I just think it hits every single one of those like small town tropes, which is that Jackson never wanted to come back, but Sadia feels like there's no way out. And and then, boom, you put them in the town together, and it's like a crucible, and it's like, what's going to happen?
Yeah.
And I think it's just really, it's really good. And often a second book in a series is like a turning point, right? And I think that this book really, like, holds, is like the glue that holds this series together in some ways, because it's resolving some of the things from book one and setting up things in book three, but it itself is such a look at like the town itself and the whole idea of like, we thought we knew something, but maybe we didn't, right? That you could still have secrets.
It's really interesting because, you know, we talk so much about Cressley in the IAD episodes leveling up. And I think if you haven't read this series, but you have read other Alicia books, you will find that what is happening here is a leveling up of sorts in terms of the scope of the stories that she's telling. This is it's three books that are, you don't have to read them all together to get the whole story. But when you do read them all together, what you're actually seeing is almost like a saga of sorts.
Oh, I think so, for sure.
It's very sort of in the vein of Danielle Steele.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's a real sense here that what Alicia is trying to do is build a family that could conceivably exist for generations. It's like Dallas.
Yes, and that's it. Like this, I think small towns really lend themselves to that like generational saga feeling. And these books were like really specifically doing that. So, you know, I feel like if you're like a soap opera lover or you love like sort of those, like this, even though
it's really meaty.
Yes.
Like it's a chewy book. Like you're
kind of famously before book three came out, I had to draw myself a map of like who was who and what was going on, because as I like to say, reading strategies are for everyone. And right, like sometimes you're not going to get that in the front of an adult book. Like that's one great thing about kids books is they're going to give you like the family tree and the map and the character chart. And I actually made one and put it on Twitter because I was like, look, everybody, you think you remember the Chandlers and the Canes, but you do not remember.
You do not remember them. No, that's really funny. No, I mean, it will come as absolutely no surprise that I think Alicia is a tremendous writer. And so I highly recommend all of these books. I highly recommend all of her books. Someday we'll do mythological retellings and I'll talk about my favorite of hers.
Yeah, Hades.
So that's that. Small towns. Tell us your favorite small towns. Tell us what you think.
And we're going to link to Bree Bridges, who's half of Kit Roca, had an amazing thread on Twitter once where she asked people, like, essentially, like, great. What do you think a small town is? And of course, I would have been like, 75,000 people?
Yeah, I think I answered it and I was like, I don't know, 15,000 people? And she was like, and somebody else was like, 250 people. I was like, what?
What?
What kind of a place? How do you do anything wrong in this town?
I mean, the pressure of that. I feel real overwhelmed already.
My daughter, who is in the kindergarten in Brooklyn, New York, her school, 125 kindergartners attend her school. So, you know, half that town is made up of kindergartners.
I was like, it's kind of sticky and a little smelly in that town.
And everyone is crying.
Oh, man. That's not my kind of town. But you know
what? We should link to that because 250 people is a whole lot. But today, I texted Jen. I saw somebody today say that they drove to see the Avengers and they drove 200 miles round trip. Would you like to know where the movie theater is in my town? It is two blocks from my house.
Yeah.
Like, if I have a sitter here at 6 p.m., I could be at a 6:15 movie.
Well, and I think that's the part that I will say, as a city dweller, I take so many conveniences for granted.
Just for granted.
Yeah. And
well, we were doing a podcast with we were doing the podcast with Sierra. And I texted you guys and I was like, I'm waiting for sushi. And then I like unpacked my sushi onto my desk as we were talking. And Sierra was like, what are you eating? Where did you get a sack full of sushi? Don't have that in Kansas. I don't know.
Yeah. Fine.
I was like, I don't know. You got to move to New York. I don't know what to say.
Yeah.
But you don't get Menage County in New York. There's no.
There is no Menage County. That's true.
I mean, there's something out here.
Well.
It's not the same.
And that's the part I think actually, like, I don't know. That's the part that I think small town romances are capturing, the nostalgia for a time when you could get all that. And I feel like really realistically speaking right now, you could get it in the big city. I think you could be a hermit in a big city. You would never have to leave your house. You can get everything you wanted delivered.
Absolutely. I mean, I am not a hermit and I get everything I want delivered.
Sometimes.
Because I'm lazy.
When I'm real lazy. That's a different thing. I just order like cat treats and Diet Coke. Fine.
Wow. Wow. No, I've never done that.
It's pretty bad.
That's special.
Amazon Prime Now. They want to bring me things.
Oh, no, I won't do it. You know. That, I mean, it really does feel like once you cross that line into cat treats and Diet Coke.
It's all over.
And you're never coming back. There was a bakery. The best birthday cake in New York City is baked by a place called Butter and Scotch over by the Brooklyn Museum. And for a little while, they delivered dummies. Their delivery zone was so, so way too big. But they would deliver a slice of their birthday cake, like a 20-minute drive in Brooklyn to my house.
That's bonkers.
And then when I finished Brazen and the Beast out in bookstores, July 30th. Hmm. P.S. I got on to the ordering system to order a birthday a slice of cake to my house,
and
they'd cottoned on to my.
To now the fact you that just I was, have to do Uber Eats.
They were
or something.
Spending more in gas than I was in cake.
Ugh, funny.
So, but Butter and Scotch, very delicious. I'll put it in the show notes. When you all come for RWA, if you come for RWA, trek out to Butter and Scotch out by the Brooklyn Museum. It's great.
All right. Small
and tell
town
them
people.
That they should increase their delivery zone back to my apartment.
You know what? Here's the important thing. If you live in a small town and we got it wrong, I think the thing remember is tell us, but also that like big city romances never feel quite right and small town romances probably don't either. Right? No. So it's not about reality. It's about that beautiful, romantic, trope-tastic
genius.
Yeah,
it's about the fantasy.
It's about the
fantasy. About the time. Oh, you know what scene I love? We didn't talk about the scenes I love, but I love the scene where they're in the, like, local watering hole, the, like, bar. And then, she's wearing whatever she's wearing, and he comes in, and she, and, like, the air shifts in the room, and she, like, looks across the room at him, and you know it's on. It's going to happen. And all those dudes know how to dance. What's that about?
I do enjoy that. Well, I will tell you, in Elia Winters, my new hero, they go into the sex shop and she has a sex swing and they try it out. And I just want you to know, God. I'm here for it. I'm here for it.
I thought you were going to say something completely different.
No, I was seriously like, I mean, and it's great because I think it's Ben. He's like, you've got a sex swing in here? And I was like, I just said that. Small towns. Cupcakes and sex wings.
You never know. You never know.
They're cool people everywhere.
This has been Fated Mates, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Sarah McLean.
I'm Jen Prokop.
And you can find us online at fatedmates.net. Don't forget to look at the show notes. They're a delight. Be sure to like and subscribe on your favorite podcasting platform. If you'd like to give us a review, we like good ones. And
pre-order Brazen and the Beast and eat a piece of cake from your favorite local bakery on
us. We give you permission. Podcast calories do not count.
I've heard that. Okay. Bye, everybody.
Bye.